pride in your work have to go along with skimping on a government contract? What if you occasionally tell somebody that Jesus Christ is your hope and try to explain to them who he is to you? Suppose you decide to tell your friends, a group that you run around with, that you prefer not to attend that kind of a movie. Suppose you decide that you're going to love and accept some nerd that nobody else wants to love and accept, but you want to develop a relationship with them and include them in your social circle. What's going to happen if you decide to dress differently, talk differently, act differently, make different decisions? If truly your mind is being transformed by the renewing power of the Spirit of God, and you stop being conformed to the timefulness of this age, and you decide to begin to live for eternal values, what's going to happen? There's going to be persecution, and you're going to face it. You're going to face it maybe not in physical persecution, but you're going to face it in social persecution and in verbal persecution and in subtle, unseen ways where the pressure is brought against you. What do you do at times like that? The natural man, when he faces injustice, when he's persecuted for something he doesn't deserve to be persecuted for, the natural man wants to cry back, curse, get vengeance. Paul says, if we're loving without hypocrisy, we don't do that. One of the illustrations of that natural thing is there are these little devices. They're sold for cars now. They make sounds like a bazooka being fired and something exploding, or a machine gun. So that if you're driving down the street and somebody makes you mad in the way they drive, you go, and you can pretend that you got even with them. That's the natural man. Somebody does something that's wrong. Somebody treats me unfairly. I'm going to let them know what's going on. I'm going to curse. Paul says, no, we don't love that way. Listen, it matters to God. It matters to God in the face of genuine, unjust hurt how you respond. Our outward Christ-like action.
Shut the hell up, you hocus pocus fool. This nonsense about what happens if you tell people Jesus Christ is your hope. Well, then they may say, tell them to help us get some health care. Tell Jesus to help us get some living wage. Tell them to help organize a strong union with us and help defeat the Imperial Zionist government and their supporters on the Christian American plantation, the Hebronic Israeli plantation, and the Islamic Sudan plantation. Then, Jesus is about something. Until then, shut up. You talk about how the nature of man, the natural nature of man, is to get back at people. And what matters is to God is how you respond. Well, well, why don't you tell that story to Christian man Boy George, who's getting back at Saddam because he said he believes Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. He's getting back at the insurgents because they don't accept his occupation. He's getting back at the citizens of Fallujah because they support the insurgent slaughter. Look, damn it, Christian. He's bombing and occupying because Boy is a Christian imperialist murderer. And he's doing it in the name of his real God, capitalism. Well, we're on a revolt in the name of our own God, freedom. You know what time it is, slave time. Check it. You're listening to 104.1, freakradio.org, Santa Cruz. 106.7, Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, and RadioForAll.net, the universe, slave revolt time. Tonight, we're going to blast into what's shamelessly going on the American plantation when a so-called internationalist lawyer is basically being a front man for imperialism. You'll see what we mean. So you got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and crowned thy good with the brotherhood of a select group of liars, cheaters, and thieves, who use that brotherhood to form the most arbitrary and ambiguous history the world has come to know. Red, white, and blue, the symbolism of hypocrisy and bureaucratic stagnation. Men of power, glossing the fault line cracks. In historical facts, red, white, and blue, those stars and stripes for never. Never again will I take a back seat, genuflect those my equal, sing that whining anthem or tatter my clothing with those tired ass colors. Blue. Blue is the mood that sweeps my emotions into a disastrousness of color me sad. Color me gray, color me gloomy when thinking of those colors, patriotic white. White are the ghost-faced pointed hoods swinging my ancestor from the tree that fed life back into earth to breed in abundance the fork-tongued serpent, erecting sacrilegious torches in the face of the phoenix who takes flight up out of the ash. Leaving that glow in its dust, its winged fans spreading a shadow over hatred. And I see red. Red are my bloodshot eyes streaming tears down that flag shrouded in glory, glory, hallelujah. My country, 'tis of thee, waving embers across purple mountains majestic only to those who believe. While in the sky, atmospheric radiation beams down, singeing surf and turf, blistering the feet of the unprepared, running, running, running from those poisonous rays, seeking to alleviate your pain, kicking your face with sunblock 2000, covering up your face, covering up your skin, covering up your history of bad blood and foul misinterpretations. Running from each other, running out of the frying pan and into the fiery douses of hell, and forever will you burn with those crosses of iniquity, and let those you've abused inherit your precious earth. So fly your flag in hell, tears streaming down its acts of change and cover-up that have insistently been deemed necessary. And I will cry. Cry social injustice. Cry racism, cry sacrilege, cry freedom from sea to shining sea. My tears will not provide you with escape. And you, your pointed hoods and your smoking crosses shall burn forever, marching in the parade of hell's fire and brimstone.
You know what time it is now. Shameless file time. The arrogance of many Americanos knows no bounds. Michael Sheriff, he's a director of the Frederick K. National Law Center, found himself in a debate and shamelessly tried to defend his position on helping, quote unquote, train in Iraq a new level of judges. And by de facto, he's defending imperialism. The debate he found himself in was with one of Saddam's lawyers, Abdul Hawakani. This was on the Amy Goodman show, Democracy Now! And we're going to go into this a little bit to expose how some of these liberals and progressives types who are in the international stage quite easily slip into basically promoting, justifying, and defending imperialism by their own actions. So let's explore this a little bit as Amy asked the first question about these lawyers or judges coming into play. And let's examine shamelessly how power is really played out. So check this out.
We're going to begin with Michael Sharp. Will this happen?
Amy, there is no way the trials are going to begin next week. First of all, the Iraqi Special Tribunal is independent, and therefore the Prime Minister and Defense Minister cannot control when it begins its trial. Secondly, the rules, procedure, and evidence for this tribunal are still being drafted, and they can't begin the trial until after that. Thirdly, there's always been a consensus that they wouldn't want to start until after the elected government was in place, because otherwise they would give the defendants an argument under the Geneva Convention that this was an illegitimate tribunal. And finally, I've been involved in training the Iraqi judges, and we still have several training sessions scheduled for the new year, so I know that they're not intending to begin anytime soon.
So are you calling Iyad Alawi a liar?
What I'm saying, there is one way to interpret what he said consistently with the truth. It is possible that they will have arraignments in the next few weeks where they bring these defendants to the court and they appoint a defense counsel and they read the charges and they ask if they plead guilty or innocent. And I suppose in a stretch you could say the trial has begun. And that would be perfectly consistent with where things stand. But the actual trial will not begin until mid-time next year.
Abdul Haqqani, also with us, the London-based attorney, one of Saddam Hussein's lawyers, also one of the lawyers representing the former Iraqi deputy prime minister, Tariq Aziz. Last year, he himself was arrested, that is our guest, Abdul Haqqani, on charges he violated the sanctions on Iraq. Your response to this announcement?
Assalamu alaikum. Well, I don't know what to think of Iyad Alawi. He's been saying for the last few months, every now and then, that there's going to be a trial, and he's immediately rebuked by the Americans who, at the end of the day, control the show. I don't know why he keeps talking about things he has got no control in. I don't think there's going to be a trial in the next month or whatever, or next 2 months. It's a political decision which is going to be decided by the Americans, and that Iyad Alawi has got no control. The anomaly of this whole mess is that the Americans hold the prisoners. Iyad Alawi seems to assume legal jurisdiction over them, which he hasn't got. And at the same time, claiming that there is a legal basis for trying them. I'm very surprised that I've just heard your first speaker talking about a court. Which court? Under which law was it created? There's no law in Iraq which allows these people to be tried for war crimes. The Iraqi law which exists under the Hague Regulation does not allow them to be tried and under any other law. If the United Nations wants to create a special tribunal, it should create so, but not couple of American professors somewhere teaching Iraqi judges to create a kangaroo or a camel court rather than a kangaroo court to try Iraqis under fictitious legal principles. This is a charade that's never been seen under international. And I don't know how Americans could really stand and argue for it. I honestly do not understand. Under which law is your speaker talking about? Which court? Which law made that court? It's Bremer who created that court. He had no authority to create a court to try people in Iraq. He had no authority to pass any regulation in Iraq, let alone change the Iraqi legal system, which, under the Hague regulation, he had no authority to do so.
Well...
Now, actually, the cat who just got through speaking, Hakualani, is basically right. I mean, this is, when you hear Sheriff talk all of this type of stuff, you know, he comes off like there's no way that this trial is going to happen. But the reason why he's basically saying that it won't happen is because they would want to start the election once the new government has been voted is put into place, elected into place. Well, what government are they talking about? A government that is being constructed by the imperialists and that is being forged through imperialist conflict and expansionism and domination. The whole thing that's going on in Iraq now is an imperialist intervention. So for this clown to get up here and basically say that it's not justified to have any kind of trial because the imperialists have no ground to stand on in the true human self-determination concept. Instead, all he's doing is basically outlining why an imperialist strategy and for imperialist illusion making would want to construct the facade of a government for this whole process then to take place, to, you know, basically put Saddam's head in the guillotines. When he goes into how he's been training these judges, basically what he's saying is he's conspiring with the imperialists. See, that's what's so tacky and sorry about many of these liberal types, progressive types, and, you know, and quite naturally, because they're aligned with them, the Democrats. They'll speak out at times about a particular injustice, but at the same time, in the act of bringing a resolution, they'll often consolidate their efforts with the imperialists to try to, quote unquote, bring some kind of harmony to the region. Because after all, the argument often goes is, we need this conflict to end. When in reality, is if the imperialists win by consolidating their own false system, their own false government, puppet government, some kind of kleptocracy, then that's not bringing conflict to an end. That, in actuality, is perpetuating imperialist conflict, where the seeds of discontent, the seeds of exploitation, are going to continue on. The fact that if the imperialists, which they're not in this case, but if the imperialists were able to subdue down the Iraqi people, and then clowns like the sheriff guy were to come in and put in and help train these little, you know, tin bag lawyers and judges, the fact that if that whole facade were to take place, that that would be some kind of move in a progressive way, in a way where it's some kind of resolution on the barbarity that is taking place amongst the people, and now, quote unquote, it's up to them to carve out their own destiny, is fallacy. No, it's an extension and a continuation of imperialist expansionism for their own means, and a perpetuation of conflict that will go. All of these clowns that have come in there have put forth various ID systems and retina eye scannings and various things of displacement of workers' rights and so on and so forth. They're there for the imperialists. And anyone who tries to justify or align themselves with is just basically another form of embedded imperialist collaborators.
You know what? The first thing you have to think about when you hear about setting up courts. Excuse me. He goes on, this brother goes on, and I want you to listen carefully to Saddam's lawyer, our listeners out there. Because at one point he says, what do we need you to set up a court? We've had courts in this, for millennia. We taught you what Arabic numerals were. And, you know, there's something to be said for that.
A little bit. We'll go into that later.
Okay. But it seems to me, no, it's not about setting up a court. It's setting up a particular court as a mechanism to carry out the will of the imperialists. And what is imperialism, really? What are we talking about? Well, we're talking about an advanced stage of capitalism that has been attained by some nations, advanced industrial nations, in the 20th century. This has been a whole new epoch of imperialism. And it opened up really when the expansion of colonialism had covered the globe and no more colonies could be acquired by the great powers except by taking them from each other. See, they had to go to war to take colonies away from each other. So how did Iraq become a colony of the United States now? Well, basically they created a fantasy. They said they had weapons of mass destruction. They were helping Osama bin Laden and a series of other lies and hogwash, all proven to be false. All proven to be false. And they attacked this country, literally killing just thousands and thousands of innocent people. Now, the concentration of capital, see what it was, so what was it? It's an oil grab. The United States imperialist wants to develop an advantage over other imperialists by having its hand on the spigot, on controlling this oil. So now they're going to set up this trial and prove that Sudan, that you know, Hussein is the bad guy. Well, they're in big trouble. They're in big trouble. Because I don't think that Saddam going to go for it. I think he's going to help to expose them. And they want to set up a situation to what we might call damage control.
Right. All right, next, Sheriff goes into the so-called independence of the court. So let's see what he has to say about this. Check it out.
Put the question to Michael Sharp, who is one of the five international law experts who trained Iraqi judges.
Amy, when I first heard about this court, I felt very much like your other guests today. I even wrote an article saying that this court seemed to me to look like an American puppet tribunal. But the more I learned about the court, especially when I got up to London and spent a whole week getting to know the judges and learning about how this is going to proceed, I learned that they have an awful lot of independence and autonomy. And even the Department of Justice office in Baghdad, which is assisting them, has been given instructions from Washington that they're on their own. They won't be given guidance or instructions on how the timing of the indictments or who to indict or how to proceed. Their only instruction is do what you think is right. And so what I learned from working with these judges is that this Iraqi special tribunal, which is consistent with international law, provided that the elected government ratifies it, is capable of doing a fair and effective trial of Saddam Hussein.
This is a retrospective activity. It does not exist at law. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to hear an international lawyer talk this rubbish. I'm sorry to say that. But what Iraqi government is going to ratify what has happened before it? This court exists now without jurisdiction. It has no authority to act. What do you mean independent judges? An independent judge appointed and the Iraqi constitution has no authority to try Saddam Hussein. He does not have that authority. Everything he is doing now is illegal. And I don't know. He takes just advice from Washington. Why should Washington decide what happens in Iraq?
You know, I expect the defense counsel to make these arguments, especially in front of the tribunal. In fact, defense counsel have argued that the Rwanda tribunal and the Yugoslavia tribunal and the special court for Sierra Leone have all been illegal or outside of international law. And when the judges look at those arguments very carefully and look at the precedents, they've always rejected those arguments.
All these studies you're talking about have had a mandate from the Security Council. You go and get a Security Council mandate to set up an international court in Iraq, and that will be legal. But don't you just go and pick a third-grade judge in Baghdad and tell me he's independent, appointed by Bremer, and tell me he's independent. None of those judges sitting on the bench, so-called bench, has got any experience in law. These are political appointees. I mean, if you go and get me a tribunal like Milosevic, I accept that. But don't appoint judges who have no authority under Iraqi law to try Iraqi officers and tell me this is legal.
All right, once again, you know, you heard the sheriff guy talk about how, he was skeptical at first, but then he learned when he went down to London that they had a lot of independence and autonomy. I mean, who is he kidding? Whoa. This is some sick stuff. It's Bremer and the rest have been calling the shots about how things are going to go. They were the ones who outlined the so-called elections. They're the ones who are deciding what neighborhood they're going to bomb next. If you have someone with your occupying army force deciding when they're going to bomb what neighborhood you're supposed to be governing over, and all you could do is bob your head, then you ain't in control of nothing.
Yo, Uncle Tom.
This is just a fraud. But this is the game that this clown is trying to get you to buy into.
That's right.
It's really kind of sick.
Yeah.
He talks about how the Iraqi tribunal is consistent with international law. Well, I mean, if that's the case, then international law is even more of a sham than it's already been exposed to be. This is an illegal invasion. What the international law, if it was truly a law set up for the independence and masses of the people, they should be setting up courts for Boy George, Colin Powell, Rumsfeld, and the rest of the Office of Special Plans crew. Because they're the ones who are outside of the bounds of true out of the legal realm of respectability and humanity. Then he says, I looked at the arguments, and they've looked at the arguments that people like Saddam's lawyer is outlining, and they have rejected them. Well, then that's even more of a condemnation on how basically this is really political. It's as political as how the Supreme Court acted during the 2000 election. These guys are bending and swaying to the wind of the imperialist, under the imperialist power of Sam. And this bum is basically legitimizing their tactics and their whims that they're throwing out there at every step of the way. Look, even under, and I've gone over this before, so I don't want to overdo it, but, you know, when the invasion was just starting, you know, I documented how the resolution that they pushed forward for their justification basically was not didn't have any legal standing. They were using things that were outdated. In other words, that gave them the right to get to push Saddam out of Kuwait, but did not give them the authority for anything else. I showed how they were making up resolutions or for the justification of bombing Saddam in the Northern Territory, even though there's nothing in any resolution that gives them the right to bomb in the no-fly zone, which they were doing at the time. In other words, every step of the way, Sam has concocted right before your eyes some kind of justification for doing what he's doing. He's the illegal party in all of this. So those who play a role in justifying what Sam is up to is basically part of that illegal party.
That's right. And, well, look, let's define. When we were talking, when I was defining imperialism, I'm trying to explain, there's a reason for that. It's important to understand the social dynamics at work here. When they say that this phony judiciary that they're setting up in London to run Iraq, to judge cases in Iraq, right? Think about that. When they talk about its autonomy, why do we know? Do what you think is right. Oh, is that what we're going to do? Yeah, right. You know what? Why do we know this is hogwash? Because there is something, see? After imperialism developed a while, the imperialists found it wasn't necessary for them to be present and be the judge as they used to do in colonial Africa, let's say. You would actually have a white British judge judging African subjects, passing judgment on them, meeting out punishment, whatever. Okay? They found that if they could do it, if they could develop a comprador class to do this for them, that they could confuse people and make it appear as if some of these subject nations were actually independent. As long as they're getting that money. That's why a lot of the bourgeois elements here in this country don't like George Bush. Because he's making it so obvious what's going on. They would much rather just use Iraqis against Iraqis. If they could. But, oh boy, George is making it so obvious that these ain't nothing but puppets. It's not going over very well. Autonomy. What kind of autonomy? You being trained in England by a white boy from the United States and then talking about you autonomous. Think about that.
Now next, Sheriff, and Hawakani steam back and forth about who the judges are in Iraq. So let's check out how this conversation goes. Check it out.
I met the judges, and I don't think you know what you're talking about. These judges have quite a bit of experience, but in general,
you know them now,
let me
you?
Just say this, but in general,
you know them now, you
no, no judge.
All right, one person at a time, Michael Sheriff, who are these judges? Let Michael Sheriff explain who they are, and then you can respond.
We're tired of this.
Okay, can you please let me finish?
Abdul Haq Alani.
We want Iraq. We don't want you in Iraq. We don't want any meddling. We have enough legal experience. We don't want any American rubbish, any American breach of international law anymore. Thank you very much.
Amy, I think you're seeing what Thomas said.
Okay, let's let Michael Sharf respond, and then Abdul Haq Alani, you can talk about who these people are. Michael Sharf?
I think you're seeing from Abdul what the defense of Saddam is likely to look like. Very emotional, not necessarily grounded in law, but as...
Grounded in law.
Can I finish, please?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Abdul Haq Alani, let Michael Sharf explain who these lawyers are.
I'll arrest you at London Airport.
Okay, so what I was saying, Amy,
against you as a criminal because you have breached every single principle under international law. I challenge you to tell me when you arrive in London, I'll have the indictment.
Well, I'm going to let you speak if you just let me finish my statement. All right.
Okay.
All right. My statement is.
Okay.
This.
Let Michael Sharf finish his statement.
I represent a detainee in Iraq. By what authority are you talking? Who appointed you? Tell me.
Can I speak now?
Yes, go ahead, Michael Sharf.
What I was saying is that even with the international tribunals appointed by the Security Council, none of the judges had any experience in war crimes law. There just aren't that many people in the world that have that experience. Basically, they're the old Nuremberg prosecutors. I have one on our faculty at Case who's 85 years old and has been very helpful to me. But those aren't the people that are being selected even for international tribunals. So these judges, you're right, they don't have experience in war crimes trials. And in fact, they're not high-level judges because those were seen as corrupted under the Saddam Hussein regime. And they're not exiled judges because those were seen as having a grudge to bear. These are judges who were vetted carefully to make sure that they were independent minds. They were vetted both by the provisional government with the assistance of the Justice Department.
A bunch of incompetent people appointed by Bremer? You're telling me that I appoint incompetent people and then I say they are competent, brilliant, brilliant. By which law is that functioning?
We're going to break, and then when we come back...
I want you to speak to a question. By what authority is he functioning? This is fundamental to law. By what? Who appointed him to function in his position? I want that answer. He's a lawyer. He should tell me who appointed him to function in his capacity.
Okay, Michael Sharf, your response.
Well, under the provisional law of Iraq, they established... not letting me respond. Okay, under the provisional law of Iraq, they established the Iraqi Special Tribunal with a statute.
Okay, we're going to go to a break, then we're going to come back. Michael Sharf at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio is one of five international law experts who helped train Iraqi judges.
Experts.
Abdul Haq Al-Ani, our other guest,
yeah.
London-based lawyer hired by Saddam Hussein's Jordanian lawyers to represent Saddam Hussein in London, also represents, among others, the former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz.
All right, now basically what's happening is this sheriff guy is just getting caught ass out. Because Haq Al-Ani is just not having it. He's all steamed up and stuff. And when you hear a sheriff go talk about, you know, these judges and so on and so forth were vetted to make sure they were independent-minded. I mean, come on. That basically means is that you are someone that will fit within the construct, the mold, and the image that we find acceptable as imperialists.
Exactly.
That's their version of independent-minded. It's like watching the Fox News show and hearing them discuss someone who they think is reasonable and someone who's far off the map. Now, anyone who really criticizes, you know, global capitalism, the IMF, World Bank policies, that challenges genetically modified organisms in the food industry and so on and so forth, will of course not be considered reasonable. Someone who comes within the fold of justifying the financial capitalist corporate system would be considered reasonable and independent and logical and rationally minded. That's how this stuff is orchestrated. And those types of people are the ones who end up getting these types of corporate-based jobs, whether we're talking about within the corporate media system or within the corporate imperialized kleptocracy system of being basically a little puppet for the ruling corporate machinery. So this is just this is some sick stuff when you hear this guy basically just outwardly try to justify the imperial expansionism and then take little pot shots at, you know, Haq Al-Ani for basically standing opposed to imperialism's role in how it warps society.
Mm-hmm.
He says that to Haq Al-Ani, "I've met the judges, so I don't think you know what you're talking about." As if you would have to meet any of these judges to decide that this whole thing is a fraud. If the people of Iraq, the masses, do not have their sovereignty, which they don't, they're not determining whether they live or die the next day. All they can determine is how, at this point, they're going to die. On their knees or in a resistance mode. And depending on how that develops will determine at the end of the day whether Sam is still having his, will be able to have his cowboy boots on their soil or not. But they're far from having their autonomy. So if the masses of people do not have their autonomy, then you can't talk about any of the other particular things within a particular society having their autonomy.
That's right.
Because the core of the people don't. I mean, so this fool is just making up stuff. So this shows you the sickness of those who, in the name of quote-unquote, bringing some kind of justice to a region, are basically part of the cord of imperial expansionism.
See, they thought they had it going on. They came in the country, caused a lot of confusion, lied to people, told them they was going to help them get rid of Saddam. And actually, people thought, well, maybe it'd be a good thing. Who knows? But see, as this thing drags on, the lessons will learn very quickly. Reality is a Brutus teacher under the boot of imperialism. So now the masses are seeing very clearly what the dynamics are. But remember, I hope our listeners will always understand this. This is about the money, the economics. It ain't about no damn justice. You can't buy justice. You can buy old Uncle Tom. You can buy a claptrap. A neo-colonial comprador. You can't buy justice. So understand, it's the economics that's driving this here. You see, they're not going to have no court or election to decide, for instance, that the nationalized oil industry that was owned by the Iraqi people as a whole will no longer be privatized, as Mr. Burma just did. There ain't going to be no vote on that, let me tell you. But there will be a revolution over it. And just clearly understand, this concentration of production and capital that has developed to such a high stage that it has created all these monopolies which play a decisive role in economic life, that's what we live in. The average American, your friends and family, don't understand that America is an imperialist country. That's why I keep coming back to this definition thing. Here's another very important characteristic of what we're living under. The merging of bank capital with industrial capital and the creation of the basis of this, what they call financial capital, to create a financial oligarchy. That's what we really have. Why do you think we have such a rough time whenever we go on strike? Because we're not dealing with one or two small companies here or a chain here and there. We're dealing with billionaires. They can fly in a whole workforce to replace us while we're striking. Look at this hotel strike that just recently happened. They flew in the whole workforce here in San Francisco. These people have billions of dollars at their command. And we need to understand that if we're going to win. The export of capital is distinguished from the export of commodities. And this acquires an exceptional importance. See, this is not the day of old where you had manufacturers making... They send money to another country. They set up facilities, you understand? And they put those foreign nationals to work running their company. They work those people for a dollar a day doing what they were paying you. $18 an hour, or closer to $150 a day, or maybe $200 a day. They paying them a dollar a day now. Think about this. That's how imperialism works. That's why you ain't got no damn job that's worth this shit. All these retail jobs is all that's left. Why should they pay you $20 an hour if they can pay somebody for doing the same work? A dollar a day. That's how imperialism works. The territorial division of the world among the biggest capitalist powers has now been completed. Imperialism is capitalism at that stage of development at which the dominance of the monopolies and finance capital has been established, in which the export of capital has acquired pronounced importance, in which the division of the world among the international trusts have begun, in which the division of all territories of the globe among the biggest capitalist powers has been completed. That's where we are. That's what's happening, and that's what this nation is about. The sooner we understand this and understand who we as working people are, where we fit in on this pyramid, that is on the bottom of it, the sooner we'll be able to find some solutions to the problems that we face every day.
Next, Amy asks Hakwalani, where are these top Iraqi prisoners? So let's check out what Hakwalani has to say. Dig this.
I wanted to ask Abdul Hakalani, where are these people right now? For example, Tariq Aziz, Saddam Hussein.
Well, are the Americans. Nobody, you see, under international law, whether they are civilian detainees or prisoners of war, there are regulations. You civilized people in the West, since the Second World War, devised the so-called Geneva Conventions, which were meant to protect people at the time of war. Now, when Iraq was occupied, every single principle under the Geneva Convention has been breached. We are not told where these people are being held. They have not been allowed to receive legal advice. They have not been able to be seen by their families. They have been denied their basic rights for the last 18 months. You ask me, you ask the American, you ask your legal advisors in Washington to tell them whatever happened to the Geneva Convention which protected these people. We don't know. Not a single lawyer has been able to see any of these detainees. We don't even know under which law they have been held, at what treatment they have received. Even the International Red Cross has breached the Geneva Convention by entering into a secret agreement with the Americans not to discuss the affairs of the detainees with their families, which is a fundamental breach of their basic human rights. We don't know. Nobody knows, except those who are holding them.
Now, what this really gets at in some other ways is that Hakwalani's right, that basically Sam has broken all of these laws that the various imperialist powers set up, under the Geneva Convention, supposedly to counteract these types of human rights abuses after World War II. So you have things like Guantanamo going on and, Abu Ghraib, so on and so forth. This shouldn't be too surprising, though, because, one, during this same time, Sam was crushing consistently the human rights of black people within his own country. Many people throughout the world after the World War II had this favorable impression about Sam without looking really closely at what he was doing within his own borders and the history of his true development. Often it was just a debate of capitalism versus Stalinism, and a distorted type of concept of, as many Arab leaders would often just say during that time, does the United States government's president believe in God? That's how one actually, came about supporting Sam, because Sam's president believed in God, some invisible man, bent his little knees like Boy George does, and the Soviets didn't, then that's what he based choosing what side he was going in. Now, both sides were wretched. Stalin was a dog, and of course we know what Sam was doing. But the whole point is to base your your decision off of which fool is bending his knees so you can have an affinity to. That's some sick stuff. But this type of barbarity is something that's always been a part of Sam's history and very nature. This is nothing new to him. It may be somewhat shocking now as the rest of the world is being thrown on the global Indian reservation. as the rest of the world is finding that Sam is continuing his westward expansionism far outside of his own particular borders. But that has more to do with one's own being cocooned within their own shell. Sam's breaching of many of these Geneva conventions is basically as a result, in part, of the fact that he is not hindered by counterposing powers and entities in the way he was before. So his expansionism and the way he this roughshod into Panama was related in part to the dissolving of the Soviet Union. His stomping like this into Iraq is related to the dissolving of the Soviet Union. His crushing the masses of his own people in ways that had traditionally been reserved for, you know, the traditional biological undesirables. But now, you know, everyone's Negro-fied in America now, so he'll outsource your job, your ass too. You know, it's related to what happened in the Soviet Union and what has gone on in the international scene and struggle throughout the world. He's the one who feels, the empire is the one who feels he can act with autonomy now. He doesn't feel restraint. So the hell with the Geneva Convention. The hell with international law. We just put that up as a preface. You know, it was just a smoke and mirrors game is what he was saying before. We don't need to oblige by that now. We here to whip some ass and take some land. And that's the only way to deal with Sam is to be prepared to whip some ass yourself or get your ass whipped.
Yeah, sure enough. Because you can see, for instance, one of those qualities I was discussing before is the formation of the International Monopoly Capitalist Associations, which share the world amongst themselves. That's the WTO. You understand? And then what happened? That got thoroughly exposed. So now they say, well, yo, you know what? We just take it. We just take it. They're absolutely right. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States does not have a serious military opponent that can make them behave. So now, here we see it. They can make up the most frivolous lies. The lies can be proven false. You wonder, after they proved that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, one would think they said, oops, excuse me, let's withdraw. That we made a mistake here. Not on your life. They ain't giving up that oil. Because you know what? There's some people believe that actually the reserves are a lot closer to a danger point in terms of extraction than most people think. There's some people think that the United States government touts 25 years of oil reserves internationally. And some people believe it's considerably less. So this is actually a desperate struggle because the bourgeoisie is so short-sighted that they don't see that. Look, they got to, you ain't got but 25 years of oil left. You ain't got sense enough to know you got to set up some alternative energy reserves of some sort. No, they're going to try to hold on to that to the bitter end.
And in part, it's because, see, what, it's really accessible oil.
That's
see,
right.
It's not that, the oil is gonna quote unquote run out, but, it's going to be, harder and harder to get oil because it's not going to be as readily available and it's not gonna be of the same quality. So it's going to take more work to refine it to a high quality.
To make gasoline.
So, in essence, the way the imperial mind works is the same way they're working this thing in their factory, their industrial factory farm, or their factory, their industrial fish systems, where they're chasing the last bluefin tuna down to numero zero. I mean, these fools, they just have no shame. In Japan, a while ago now, one bluefin tuna sold for over $140,000. Now, the reason why is because there is a shortage of bluefin tuna, and there's a shortage of many of the type of game fish that, you know, human beings eat. There's plenty of jellyfish out there, but, you know, swordfish and all of that have dropped to about 10% of their population of years ago. So, you know, sea bass and all of them have taken a catastrophic toll. Now, in a sane society, in a rational world, there would be a step back by those who are fishing, because after all, this is even based in their own livelihood. But the way the market systems work, they can't, they just can't, because they have profit incentives and goals that come around every quarterly. And the fact that the resources are becoming more scarce makes it in the capital market system more valuable. So they become more ruthless in their hunt for them. This is what's happening in part with oil. This is in part what's starting to take place with water. As you see the Bechtels of the world become more manipulative and ruthless in trying to privatize water and control the resources of this living energy system. This is the way the market systems work, and this is why they have to go. Now next, Amy asked Sheriff about the lawyers for the Iraqi prisoners not being allowed to see him. So let's see what he has to say about this. Check it out.
Michael Sharp, what about this? In fact, Abdul Haq Alani went to try to see Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, at the airport where he believed he was being held and he wasn't allowed to. What about the fact that none of these men have been able to see their attorney?
Well, here's the interesting thing about that. The Iraqi Special Tribunal and the Department of Justice Baghdad office have created a process for Iraqi lawyers to register to represent any of the defendants that are being held in custody. And as soon as they register and they are the lawyer on record, of course they're allowed under international law to see their client. And what's most surprising is that Abdul and his colleagues have refused to do this. And I think it's because they want to manufacture an illegitimate argument to attack the process, an argument that's not really true, because all they have to do if they want to see their client is register. Now, there are 50,000 or so Iraqi trained lawyers that are registered to practice in Iraq, and the only requirement is that the lead counsel who registers has to be somebody who's a registered lawyer in Iraq. So there's plenty of people who could be doing this, and none have stepped forward yet.
Abdul Haq Alani, your response.
That's a lie. That is a lie. That is a blatant lie.
No,
when I went to Iraq, there was not even a tribunal set up. I met the colonel at the presidential palace who claimed to be the advisor to the American CPA.
Oh, when was it?
Him, I forgot his
when
name.
Were you there?
Well, hold on a minute.
Tell me when you were there.
Can I speak, please?
No, when was that, though? Can you clarify?
That was in July 2003.
Okay, but we're talking now
about
December 2004. I'm not lying about you. How things are now.
Let you finish. Let me finish. Let me finish, please. Yeah, I let you finish. Let me. I didn't interrupt you.
Okay, go ahead.
I met the colonel. I asked him, under which law are you holding Tariq Aziz? Is it international law? He said no. Is it American law? He said no. Is it Iraqi law? He said no. I said, under which law? He said, we decide when he is entitled to get legal aid. That is about the most blatant breach of law I've ever heard. And don't tell me, I don't give a damn about who the judges are in Baghdad and the process of I recognize, I have no problem. I can apply tomorrow to go and see Tariq Aziz. But can I assure you, I will not. I want to see Saddam Hussein next week. If you are really competent, arrange it for me. I'll go to Baghdad and see him tomorrow. Okay? But that is all fictitious, because you know the fundamental principle. These people have been denied their basic human rights. You know it, and the longer you deny it, the more, the cruelest, unprincipled, unlawful principle you are upholding, which is at the heart of the American invasion, which is at the heart of the decadence of American society, which elected a man like George Bush, who doesn't even know where Geneva is, let alone he knows what the Geneva Convention are. This is where the problem is.
Abdul Haq Alani, what about...
People in the world came to invade the most civilized people of... We gave you life, we gave you alphabet, we gave you... All you've got is a grudge against our civilization. You're bankrupt, culturally, morally, legally. You've got the phantoms, the F-16s, the F-18s, the tanks. You can't do that. But culturally, legally, morally, you're completely bankrupt. Thank you very much.
Abdul Haq...
I don't have any more time to talk to any trash of a lawyer in America. Good day, please.
Abdul Haq.
All right, so as Abdul stomped off after basically going off, you know, when a sheriff said there's plenty you can do to come forward and represent, you know, people like Saddam and all that, but none have come forward yet. This is really sick. Because, see, as Haqqalani found himself, you remember when they found Saddam not too long after that, they paraded him in front of the TV. I'm talking about when he came in front of the judge. They had that judge there, and Saddam was, you know, kind of aggressively asking questions and seeing what was going on and all of that. He didn't have any representation at all. You had Haqqalani back then in 2003 of July go down there, and he couldn't see him. What does Sheriff think? Well, I'm talking about now. Well, look,
that's right.
Your international hoodlum friends, they, the imperialist forces, had Saddam in front and in court giving the whole charade of justice being done. So they were putting on the front, and at the time, they weren't allowing Saddam's lawyers to check him out. So to jump back and say, what I'm talking about now is all a fraud. It's sick. Here you have a situation where Haqqalani goes down there and say, okay, well, what are you holding him on? And, you know, all this type of stuff. Is it international law? No. American law? No. Iraqi law? No. Why can't I see him? It's the law of the gun.
That's it.
That's what Sam is about. So, that's how the imperialists work at the end of the day. They show you their fangs. Now, when Haqqalani goes into this, that, you know, you guys got a grudge against us, you know, we're the most civilized and that's why you invade us. That, I mean, that's just rhetoric and stuff. It sounds good for little nationalists and, you know, hocus pocus, Islamic chauvinists. But I mean, don't give me this most civilized stuff. There's still a whole bunch of black people called the Zanj who are a result of the slave trading that took place in her slave rebellion in, Iraq. That took place. One of the largest slave revolts in history, in the annals of black history, took place in Iraq. Not against the Christian slaver, not against Columbus's Christian pilgrims, but the Christopher Columbus with turbans on. I mean, that's just the hardcore reality. So when these fools start getting into who civilized and who gave what and all of that type of stuff, they're all been in this expansionist mode.
Right.
Nubia was destroyed by Arab Islamic invaders. That's what destroyed Nubia. Nubia existed as a civilization before there was a Christianity, before there was Judaism, and before there was an Islam. Before any of that hocus pocus stuff took place, there was a Nubian civilization that had all of the concepts of civilization, quote unquote, writing, mathematics, its own set of laws, its own arts, its own medicine, science, its own, you know, basic body of development and so on and so forth. That was destroyed by the same part of civilization that Haqqalani is talking about, some invaders. They got into Egypt basically the same way under Muhammad Ali during the 7th century, you know, burning and looting. So I'm not at all into all of this hocus pocus stuff about who's, you know, the most civilized. You know, the Indus Valley in India had one of the great civilizations of ancient time. All human beings under the right condition can develop themselves in astounding ways. The fact of the matter is kind of comical to hear some of these guys cry, like Haqqalani, on a certain level about, these cats from the West, these brutes from the West invading, you know, the most civilized, like where he's from, when in many ways it was the Islams that helped spark off this whole 500 years of catastrophe. There would be no Christopher Columbus and no Spanish invasion into the New World and all the catastrophe that took place if there had not been an Islamic invasion by the Moors into Spain. I mean, that's just the real world. They conquered an indigenous people and maintained their conquering over that indigenous people for 800 years. Those people weren't bothering nobody. Those people were basically just kicking it just like the Iraqis were kicking it until Sam put his boots into them. And in 1491, when through their own movement, you know, a Christian-based movement, they pushed out the Moors, the Islamic Moors, who are primarily black. There were some Arab Moors, but it was primarily black Moors, but they were Islam nevertheless. When they pushed them out in 1491, 1 year later, 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue, and the world has never been the same. So for all the Christians, Islams, and Hebrons, let's get it right. Those who expand at the peril of other humans, don't call yourself civilized, no matter how many books you got about yourselves and how well you can write in your language. Now, as Haqqalani stormed off and left Amy and Sheriff in a lurch, Amy tries to ask the Phantom Haqqalani a question, but Sheriff takes over to spin it off. So let's see how this takes place. Check it out.
A question, though. Why have you not just registered now? Is it that you're not recognizing the authority? You're saying it's an illegitimate authority in Iraq? Why not register now as Saddam Hussein's lawyer in Iraq?
I think he signed off, Amy. But
okay.
I think the answer is a little bit clearer by his behavior. He was talking about the situation during the war a year and a half ago. I'm talking about the situation as it exists today. The lawyers, including Abdul, are still claiming that they can't see their clients. But there is a process in place, and if they register, they will be allowed to see their clients. And the Justice Department and the Iraqi Special Tribunal judges are very anxious to have these defendants be represented by lawyers, and they want that to happen as soon as possible.
What's the difference between July 2003 when Abdul Haqqalani went to Iraq, he is an Iraqi attorney, went to the Baghdad airport and was not allowed to see his client? What's the difference?
Well, since then, you know, sovereignty has passed to Iraq. At the time he was there, it was before the United Nations Security Council resolution was adopted. Bremer was still running the country as an occupied country, and he was trying to deal with occupied military forces. Now, sovereignty is switched over, including judicial sovereignty, and there is a judicial process in place to make sure that the Iraqi Special Tribunal is a legitimate court that follows the human rights that are required under international law.
But as you're saying right now, that there is no legitimate way to proceed with any trials.
Well, I would say that they should wait until the elections and have the elected government approve the Iraqi Special Tribunal to erase any argument that the provisional government was not authorized to create the tribunal. It's clear under international law that an occupying government can't create a special tribunal. It's unprecedented and unclear what a provisional government can do. And so the thought was always, let's wait for an elected government to approve this process, and once then, they can begin the trial.
That's kind of some sick stuff. See, here Amy kind of fell short because she should have pressed this clown a little bit more. When he talks about the difference now is that since 2003, when Hakolani was down there, sovereignty has passed to the Iraqi, to Iraq. Wait, in other words, he's basically saying then Iraq is not occupied because it has its sovereignty. So
what's
then,
the troops doing there then?
Yeah, and also what she should have then asked was, then why is there Iraqi resistance? And do you define that resistance as illegal? Because if you define the resistance of what the Iraqis doing as illegal, then basically you're saying that the imperialist power, the occupying power, as you know, I'm not going to call it, is basically justified in being there. So flush this clown out, because he is basically condemning the resistance that's taking place under the whole auspices of the Iraqis have their sovereignty. Because, you know, if they got their sovereignty, what you resisting for? You know?
Exactly.
So then he goes on to say that it's clear under occupation that you can't have, you know, these types of trials and so on and so forth. But it's kind of unclear under a provisional government. So in other words, he's playing word game.
That's
but
right.
He's still trying to pretend that we can't look at Iraq as being under occupation.
Head
even
topic.
Though you have a situation where it's the U.S. government and its troops deciding where and when they're going to shoot up the place, what neighborhood they're going to do.
At will.
If you have a situation where they're casually talking about retina scanning and work brigades on the citizens of the country that they're occupying. If they're talking that type of stuff, then whatever puppet government that they have in place is not sovereign. It's just smoke and mirrors, and he knows it.
Ain't much of a smoke and mirror, actually.
What this dude is saying is trying to play a smoke and mirror game.
Absolutely, I think, but it's just not much. It's kind of nutty. Because just as you said,
that's why Amy should have pressed him.
Well, Amy might be with him. I'm sorry to say that. I mean,
I'm not saying she is or isn't. I mean, she may be, she may not. But regardless of the fact, she should have pressed them.
Well, let's put it this way. I've seen her more aggressively interview people that come up with absurd statements like this before. Now, I guess you just captured it. When you see, this man is what's called a charlatan. That's what you call people who just come up with these ridiculous, because here's how the argument goes. So just in case you weren't aware, our listeners should know. Basically, the United States is not occupying Iraq, according to the imperialists. You know, this is a fairy tale. No, there's an Iraq government there who have asked the United States to kind of stay around for a while and make sure we don't have so much trouble, because we haven't yet created the killing machine that can go out and kill our citizens at will like you guys do. So right now, we'd like the U.S. Army to do the killing for. This is just ridiculous. Ridiculous. Nobody supports that government, and they know it. If they left, you know what? If they left, the most likely thing that might occur is a strong Islamic government would emerge. Anti-U.S., anti-imperialist.
even if it were capitalist. And also, there is the possibility of other types of revolutions occurring. So that's why they know it's an unstable situation. They don't want to leave. Not yet. Not until they get all the little compradors and charlatans lined up and got their little job, know what to say, who to do, what to say, you know. And then, eventually, they'll leave. May have to come back. But they would rather leave. Don't. You know, they're not just there because they ain't got nothing better to do than kill babies. They have to maintain social control. That's what they're after. And that's what they're not going to have. That's what the imperialists must have. Because they cannot, what? They cannot extract super profit without social control. See, they thought they was going to go in there and get that oil and be swimming in oil. Shit, them insurgents is cutting them lines and carrying on. They ain't getting nothing out of Iraq. Hardly anything, actually. It's so low, they don't even have oil in Iraq.
So, well, that's not why. they're priorities.
Well, true. They're not getting much oil, though. Check. They're not.
Well, as I told you before, they're only getting like 12 to 15%.
Exactly.
Now, this wasn't their plan, of course. This is connected to the particular situation that they found themselves in with the declining dollar value. Because, you know, the U.S. dollar is weak. Everything is pushing past the U.S. dollar strongly. The euro, the yen. Part of the reasoning for them stomping over into Iraq was to prop up the U.S. dollar. They changed the way that Saddam sold petrol, which was in U.S. dollar, or was in the euro, because he changed it over from the U.S. dollar to the euro. They changed it back to SAM. And then they thought that they could, of course, artificially get it jacked up back into semi-respectable levels with what they were going to pour out of Iraq. That didn't take place because there's so much resistance and chaos from their standpoint going on that they're only getting 12 to 15% of the oil out that Saddam was getting out just a few years ago. So this is hindered and wobbled the U.S. Dollar even more so. This also put Sam in a vulnerable position when the Venezuelan recount was taking place. They would have been much more active in trying to destabilize Chavez the second time around. But since they were vulnerable because of what was going on with the U.S. dollar and what was going on overall in Iraq, they just had to kind of pull back and stuff because they get a lot of petrol from Venezuela, and they weren't in a position to act a fool through helping out their little, you know, market capitalist buddies in Venezuela. That's why many of the Venezuelan elite are calling Sam a traitor now. But, you know, Sam's just looking out for his own imperialist interests, and he was too vulnerable to go stomping ahead. Now, part of the reason why I said that, Amy was weak and, should have been, more active on that, you know, I don't want to over speculate and say, you know, she was with him or may have been with him. I mean, this may be her, weakness from a class standpoint. But the reality is that, this dude was too full of contradictions for, someone who, wants to flush out and should be flushing out these things on an international class level to let some buffoon like this slide by. Hold on a sec.
There was a street fight where One young man named Jeremiah Alvarez English was killed by Chad O'Connell. Chad O'Connell, who was 16 at the time, had confessed to the killing. But instead, the two friends of Alvarez English were charged with the murder under a very unusual murder rule. They were on their way to Moreno's uncle's house, and they were in that neighborhood. It was kind of an affluent, upscale neighborhood of Vacaville, primarily white. And on the way there, they were accosted by young men and boys on the street, and they started yelling at the car. Now, previously, Moreno's car had had a window smashed and broken like the night before, and just before the incident on the night of the murder, someone threw something and broke a window of his car again. So there was, the people on the street had provoked, the anger of the people in the car. Jeremiah Alvarez English at that time jumped out of the car to confront the people on the street. There were 8 to 10 people on the street, and David Moreno and Justin Pacheco went out to try to get him back in the car. But things kind of went awry at that point. The fight kind of got a little heated, and English, Alvarez English in the fight was stabbed in the back. And when the fight was over, the fight was ending because they thought, let's get out of here. The cops could come any minute. So they jumped back in the car. When they got back in the car, they realized that Alvarez English had been stabbed in the back. They rushed him to the hospital where he later died. He had a lung punctured and his liver was sliced. The knife that Chad O'Connell had wielded was 11 inches long and had his name inscribed on it. He admitted to having that. He had also fashioned a weapon with a club made from, with bolts sticking out of at the end of it. He had actually worked to screw in bolts into the top of the club, and he was going to use that as a protective weapon, he said. But it looked more like an offensive weapon, and that had been determined by Moreno's lawyer in this court case right now. The very next morning after the murder, O'Connell and his lawyer were having a conversation with Deputy District Attorney Kathy Geiser in her office, and it looks like that's probably when it was decided that he was going to go free and that the murder charges were going to be placed on the two Latino men. So what you have is a case where two Latinos receive unequal and more harsh treatment by the district attorney's office in Solano County, and a white youth goes free. It's quite outrageous, especially when I've been sitting in on the trial, and the prosecution has had numerous witnesses come forward, and none of their stories match. O'Connell himself, on the witness stand, has admitted to a string of lies. He's lied to detectives. He's lied to the judge in preliminary hearings. He's lied in the previous hearing. And he's admitted to all of these on the current, on the witness stand, the current trial. It's a murder rule act called the Provocative Murder Rule. And it's been around since, 1965. And it hasn't been used very much. What it does is allow the prosecutor to charge an accomplice to a crime that results in a death, with the murder, even though murder wasn't the intended effect of the crime. It's mostly been used in, say, a robbery case where a robber tries to rob, say, a convenience store, and maybe the clerk manages to fight off the robbery. But in so doing, he might have a gun. The clerk might have a gun. He might shoot a bystander. And what the DA can do, he can charge the robber with the bystander's death, and that would be a murder charge. That's often how it's been applied. It hasn't been applied very much. In Solano County, though, it's been applied to another case, very similar to a robbery. It was a robbery case, and it was two men tried to rob a man on the street, and the man on the street managed to get the murder weapon and kill one of the robbers and the accomplice to the robber. Even though he didn't have the weapon to begin with,
he was charged with the murder and he's put away 25 years of life. It hasn't been used very much. It's never been used. This act, this murder rule, has never been used for a street fight. It's really unclear. The prosecution has not been able to make a case for how it got started. Moreno and Pacheco, they both contend, and their stories match, where none of the prosecution's witnesses' stories match. But Moreno and Pacheco's stories match that they were trying to get their friend back into the car to save his life, and they were in fact charged with the murder. They were also they've been prosecuted. The DA has tried to make a case against them that they are gang members, and essentially he's relying on the fact that they're Latino and people's assumptions about Latinos and like Latino gangs to make a case against them. And he's trying to prove that the DA has to prove that they provoked the fight and they started the fight. If he can prove that they provoked the fight, then he has a case to put these murder charges on them. But he's trying to say that they're gang members, and that would help to kind of influence the jury to see them as provocateurs rather than defending their friend. What they did was they went to his room, into his house, and all they could find was blue. They could only find like blue shirts, but they found one maroon shirt, and so they were trying to say that he was part of the Norteño gang, whose color is red, and so they brought that shirt into court and proclaimed it as evidence. That shirt, along with a pair of khaki pants that David Moreno wore at his job. He had a job. He worked 6 days a week, 9 to 5, at a warehouse. And he wore these pants at his job. So they brought these things in to say that he was a gang member. There was no other evidence. There was no history. David Moreno did not have a record. There was nothing to like really say concretely that he was part of a gang. But these trumped-up charges were they tried to corroborate these charged charges, you know, with a shirt. And it's just absolutely mind-boggling and ridiculous that they could even, you know, influence a jury with that. It just boggles the mind to see how the actual killer, who has, you know, a history of violence, who has a collection of knives with his name inscribed on him, can be let go and to charge instead two Latinos with the murder. There's nothing really to there's no concrete evidence that they had willfully started this fight, and yet they're trying to force this down the jury's throats, this whole story. Also the fact that he's so eager to use the fact that they are Latino to link them up with gangs. This is clear that race is his method of getting his conviction. There are five jurors after the conviction of guilty. They stepped forward the day after, and they had signed affidavits saying that they voted against their conscience, that after 6 days of deliberation, where they were bullied and pressured, they were not allowed to speak openly. They were actually physically prevented from communicating with the judge. Notes they had written to the judge were crumpled and thrown in the trash. Some of the jurors had picked up the murder weapons and swung them around in an intimidating way. After 6 days of this, they just kind of cowed down and they voted for guilty. And they felt so terrible about this. The next day they stepped forward and they claimed that they did not agree with the guilty verdict. So the first case was thrown out by the judge. What was more egregious was that when the judge asked for a new trial, he tried to make sure the judge could not rule on any felony cases again, and he actually wrote a memo to his staff asking them to review all cases going to the judge, Judge Luis Villarreal, and have them move to another judge. And one of his staff persons had leaked this memo to the press, and D.A. Paulson had fired that staff person. So he's taken a very personal responsibility and a personal umbrage to what's happened in this case so far. Just saying all along that these charges should never have been made in the first place. Villarreal had actually dropped the charges, and we thought it was all going to come to an end. That was back in 97. But D.A. Paulson had the charges reinstated with another judge. And so what we're seeing is that these charges have been made when, in fact, they're based on a pack of lies, O'Connell's lies, and many inconsistencies with his friend's stories. And these charges, they don't make any sense because of that. But in spite of that, because he's applied this provocative act rule and says they provoked the fight, it may not matter what lies come out as long as his staff person can prove that they provoked the fight. These murder charges can stand, and we're really hoping that the jury will not let this go through.
The barbarity of America and its judicial system and the fools within it know no bounds. Whether you're talking about on the streets of America where this travesty takes place, or the streets of Fallujah, where the empire, where the beast roams, it needs to be destroyed by any and all means necessary. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.
When some get together and think of rap, they tend to think of violence. But when they are challenged on some rock groups, the result is always silence. Even before the rock and roll era, violence played a big part in music. It's all according to your meaning of violence and how or in which way you use it. Oh no, it's not violent to show in movies the destruction of the human body. But yes, indeed, it's very violent to protect yourself in a party. And oh no, it's not violent when under the Christmas tree is a lookalike gun. But yes, of course, it's violent to have an album like KRS-One. By all means necessary, it's time to end the hypocrisy. What I call violence, I can't do, but your kind of violence is stopping me. By all means necessary, the rap audience must grow up. The same type of fighting we do, they do, except we've got nothing to blow up. It doesn't matter if you win or lose, it's only how good you play the game. This is the oldest sneak attack, because it takes away our senses to gain. If all I do is play the game, then I am just mediocre. We strive to be the best we can be, not to just get over. Some people say that life on a whole is serious and nothing is funny. But that's only if you base your life around competition and money. Yeah, I'm making some money, he's making some money, but none of these things are necessities. What I find to be a necessity is controlling a positive destiny. With this, money, fame, glory, and credit will come in time. The people down with me know this. Every day they hear me saying rhymes. I got some friends, I got some allies, like Stet and Big Daddy Kane. They know, by all means necessary, that peace is the name of this game. Whether peace by war or peace by peace, the reality of peace is scary. But we must get there, one way or another, by all means necessary.